Though they rode through the midst of the Shire all the evening and all the night, none saw them pass, save the wild creatures, or here and there some wanderer in the dark who saw a swift shimmer under the trees, or a light and shadow flowing through the grass as the moon went westward. And when they had passed from the Shire, going about the south skirts of the White Downs, they came to the far downs into the towers, and looked on the distant sea. And so they rode down at last to Mithlond, to the Grey Havens, and the long Firth of Lune, the Grey Havens. Today on The Grey Company, we discuss the most recent big box expansion and the beginnings of the Dream Chaser cycle. Hobbits on boats, pirate-eating bears, seafaring elves, and so much more on this episode of The Grey Company. But before we dive in, we're going to hear about the state of the game from my co-hosts. Dan, how are you, sir? And what is the state of the Lord of the Rings LCG for you these days?
It's good. It's good. I don't have nearly as much time to play it as I'd like, yeah. But I finally got a chance to play solo through the three quests from the Grey Haven, so, yeah. Which is appropriate for this episode.
It is good. But, we like to do our research. Yeah, I felt the same way. Unfortunately, as Ian often says, we just end up playing on Octagon. Not necessarily because we want to, because I like to have the cards, but just having the opportunity to jump in and play a game solo, or I got to play with my buddy John, who lives in Tennessee last week. It's just the convenience factor tends to win out most of the time. But I'm happy to say I did get to play through Grey Havens, and I will save those thoughts for later. Ian, how's the game been for you lately? What have you been up to?
It's been good. The state of the game pretty much for me is the Grey Haven, so I'm not sure how much to say separate from that. I have been, you know, before the Grey Havens came out, trying to finish off the Land of Shadow stuff and killing a spider, and pretty excited about the new Nightmare stuff coming out, but it's like I don't know when I'm ever gonna catch up on Nightmare, because I'm fairly far behind, and I guess it's just the thing one day when the game does end, knock on wood, that'll be many years from now, there'll be a ton of Nightmare stuff to catch up on.
Right.
So it's only been a couple weeks since the Grey Havens came out, but we've had the opportunity to play, the community has weighed in, and really, just off the bat, I'll say it's a great expansion. I think a lot of people were apprehensive about being on boats, but let's start the discussion there. How do we feel about navigating the seas? Does it feel unnatural for the game? Did they make it work? What are your guys' takes about sailing before we even get into anything else?
I really enjoy it, and first off, I'll say that usually I try to be a bit kind of cautious about my initial ratings of a box, because I've learned through playing this game, sometimes you really like a quest and then like a year later you never play it again, even though you thought you loved it at first,
right?
And vice versa. But I have to say, this is immediately my favorite deluxe expansion, and I have no qualms in saying that. I'll just lay that down.
Wow, that's a bold claim.
You heard it here first, people.
No problem. There are others that I love a lot. It's hard to rank them, and doing the rank is hard, but Grey Havens is the easy number one for me, and I guess I'll get into the reasons for that later on. But to answer your specific question about sailing, I think it would have been really easy to make it too complex. And that's something I would probably fall into if I was designing it, because I do love the complexity. And so, like, you know, having players, like, measure out the wind and, like,
you'd actually need to go buy an astrolabe or, like,
and having little squares to move around on a chart or something. But,
The lunar tides affect how sailing works. Is that how? Nice.
Yeah, totally. And so it may be a bit more complex than a regular quest, because there is this extra layer. But I would say in general, I think they added a new wrinkle, and it will take time for players to get used to it, but it's not like super out there that it just totally, changes the feel of the game too much, or it's too complex where it's hard to get your head around it.
Well, it's just kind of like, it's like, you know, a a sneak test or a hide test, but with a really cool compass, right? Is that fair?
Right. Yeah.
I love that you brought that up, because that's exactly what I was thinking, is that I actually like it more than all those others, because it feels so much more thematic to me that, okay, you have to have certain characters work the rigging or, like, look out and look for, you know, weather patterns or whatever it is that these characters that you're exhausting to do the sailing test are doing. And it just feels right. And then you have the fact that the ships are a part of that. And if you want to use them to focus on sailing with them versus having them for other things, it's a choice you have to make, and it makes it so much more interesting than like a hide test or all these other tests we've had throughout the game, I think.
I would agree with that. And one thing that struck me immediately was that all of these cards, even these sea-related cards like Mithlin Sea Watcher, Grappling Hook, Anchor Watch, my fear was that, I don't know why I thought this, because they don't do this kind of thing, but that there were going to be cards specific to sailing. And there weren't. Like, they're, you know, the ships obviously help you a lot on the sailing test, but there are no cards that are specifically for and possibly only useful for this box. There are a lot of them that are super helpful for this box, but they're all useful across the board, which I thought was a nice touch that they were subtle enough to have these cards that were thematic and helpful to the box, but are still useful for any other quest you want to go back and do.
Yeah, the Lindon Navigator is the one that I would say is, like, it's good elsewhere, but it's so good for sailing
so
tests.
Good.
Yeah.
But I'm with you, Derek. It's definitely still a general purpose expansion, which is good.
Yeah. And I had the distinct pleasure and honor of playing this with Mike, the Master of Lore. Even though he lives halfway around the world, we finally lined up our schedules. I was playing on a Friday night. He was playing on Saturday morning. And that was the first time I got to play this. And, you know, we were obviously geeking out because we do the Master of Lore blog together. But I think, you know, something that we noted that just mechanically was that the ships are key. Depending on what, you know, you can obviously build a power deck and power through that way. But the ships are really clutch in terms of how you choose to use them and what you choose to exhaust them for. I think we had gotten to this discussion a little bit with the, what did we call it, Ian? Like the Getting Better or like the How to Get Better episode?
Yeah.
And, you know, we talked about how choosing when to exhaust your characters is important and so on. But I feel like that's really important with the ships because you can only use them, they're the only ones that can defend against other ships. You can't pump them up with attachments. And so when we chose the ships that best fit our decks and we used them correctly, that was when we finally were able to succeed on that first quest.
Yeah, and I think that's what's good about it, is that this game ultimately is all about, you know, putting pressure on you, making you make hard decisions about what you use your characters for. And so the ships and sailing, like you're saying, is basically just adding another layer of these special characters and then deciding what you're going to do. And, you know, in general, I usually find myself using them for defending because no one else can defend a ship or, you know, questing or throwing the Dream Chaser in to help with sailing tests, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it definitely adds, this kind of extra layer, that's cool. Now that we have a sailing quest, I'm curious if someone will eventually create a custom quest where you're trying to hunt down the FFG boats and get the nice. Get the games off them before they take, you know, 5 months to reach shores.
That's funny.
Yeah, I think when the island of Numenor sank, spoiler alert, that's actually where all the FFG boats went. I wanted to actually, on a serious note, comment on something that you said, Ian, is I really like that they decided to have only your ships can defend enemy ships' attacks. Mm-hmm. I think that was a great design decision because it's part of what makes it feel more thematic. Is it would have been really kind of silly if I can run like, you know, like say a Gondor deck and throw out a Squire of the Citadel and have him block like a war galley. That's just, that feels kind of wrong. So the fact that like it goes into, it's one of the reasons why, you know, your comment, Derek, which is absolutely true, is that the decisions you make around the ships are very, very important. And one of the big reasons for that is unless you have a feint or some other way of preventing an attack, you know, you could have the ships do not have, the enemy ships do not have weak stats. So that's a big attack coming through that if you're taking it undefended because all your ships are exhausted, that's going to take a chunk out of one of your ships. And they're all very critical to survival in the quest. Definitely. So
Yeah, and I think this game is at its best when the kind of theme and mechanics are very closely related. And how I can measure that is when it's easier or harder for me to kind of figure out what's happening story-wise in my head. like I'm generally pretty good at kind of twisting things around and coming up with story explanations. but I think the quests are at the best. Like, when I'm playing that first quest, the sailing, a lot of times it just makes sense. Like, yeah, I went into a fog bank and ships can't attack me. That makes sense, you know? Or this storm blew me off course right into the path of these ships that are approaching. And so that's cool. And I do think the whole, like, ship rules, like Dan said, reflect that because, no offense to anyone who plays the Star Wars LCG, but one of the things that initially just put me off that is the fact that you have, like, Y-Wings battling stormtroopers and all
Luke's
kinds of
gonna
weird stuff.
Luke's gonna one-shot a Star Destroyer.
Yeah, totally. And it's like, yeah, of course you can come up with an abstract, like, crazy explanation for anything, you know? Like,
Ewoks throw rocks really far to hit those TIE fighters. They can really hurl that stuff.
Yeah, totally. You can, but again, it's like I'm saying, like, when you don't have to as much, I think that's a sign of good design. And in this, yeah, the rules and kind of work together that it makes sense in my head. And
until Legolas and the Fornos Bowman take down a ship. You know, it's like. One shot, you know, how do you justify that? Like, you know, if you're taking movies.
Have you not seen the movies, Derek?
I was going to say.
Legolas can kill anything with one
yeah,
shot.
Yeah, seriously.
Not including a movie Legolas, but it's like one shot, like, he just hits the right side of the prow and it starts taking on water and it sinks. You know, there's stuff like that.
Yeah.
How rangers with swords are doing. But, you know, you
I mean, I assume it's like them jumping on board the ship and like setting stuff on fire and whatnot.
Yeah,
but,
that's fair. Yeah. I'm gonna go with that from now on.
and honestly, I mean, I don't think it's too big of a leap. There's a boarding keyword on all the enemy ships,
right,
so like that's what's happening from the other direction, right? Like that's how these random enemies, these raider and corsair enemies, are fighting you.
Right.
Is that they're pulling their scouting ship or their war galley or whatever up, you know, alongside you, and then a bunch of guys are jumping. Using ropes or whatever and jumping over and getting onto your ship, and then
yeah.
There's going to be combat there. So, I mean, it makes sense that it would go the other way, that Legolas is going to jump onto the other enemy ship and, you know, kill the right guys or whatever.
Or it's kind of like
in
Street Fighter II when Ryu, like, just punches the crap out of a car.
Awesome. Oh, that's
yeah,
such a great mental image.
Sure.
It's just actually just Gimli with his axe just, like, bashing the ship until there's nothing left, and then it sinks, and then he goes, oh, no, what am I going to do? I can't swim.
Speaking of boarding, I do like there's that one treachery that can cause a Corsair enemy to engage you regardless of whether there's a ship or not. So I like to think it's just like a Corsair hiding underwater and he just kind of leaps out at you as you're sailing by. He was riding.
He's been swimming the whole time, yeah.
Riding along on a piece of the ship.
Yeah.
But one of the things I do like about that first quest, though, is... I think with a lot of quests, especially lately, you are definitely forced into the combat route to some extent if you want to beat it. And this is a quest where you can actually run away and just try to quest and sail through and avoid enemies as much as possible.
Which feels just as heroic, right? Like, especially that last phase where it literally presents you the option of sailing away. You just kind of think about, like, Pirates of the Caribbean or Master and Commander, your favorite nautical movie where the score swells up and you're just outpacing the enemy and you
totally
flip them the bird as you sail off into the sunset. Which, ironically, is a swan when elves give the bird. That's what they call it.
Yeah, because that's the problem when they do that sometimes, is it just makes the quest boring because combat is the exciting part, right? But there's something about the interaction with the sailing test and these locations and everything else that, like you said, actually makes it feel fun to take that escape approach.
Yeah, and the fact that the scouting ship gets minus 15 engagement when you're off course, it's if you want to go the runaway route, you really have to dedicate... energy actions of your characters to the sailing test, because that's the only way you're going to stay on course. That and, you know, deal with the treacheries. It's It's one of the best quests I can remember in a long time, where the treacheries tie in thematically so perfectly.
Yeah.
Because, like, when a treachery, you know, I'd have to pull up specific ones, but there's ones where it's like, oh, you either do this or you're off course. And when you look at the, like, it's a weather and the names of these cards, and it just makes so much sense that you have, like, bad weather that's messing with you and when you're trying to sail. It's like, you know, it's really, to go back to, I think it was your comment, Ian, where, as you're playing along, it's not a leap for my mind to be like, oh, we just ran into a storm, that now we're off course.
And being off course is exciting, and you want to avoid it, but it's not so punishing. Like, there was only a couple times where we were just caught in the worst possible weather. I keep calling it weather because that's the icon, but I guess technically we were just really off course. And the next round, we got lucky and we got the double sailing wheel. And we were back on course. So we had like one terrible round where we're off course and all these triggers are firing off. And then we managed to get back on course. And it was exciting and challenging without being punishing. So very nicely executed.
Definitely.
Well, we spent a lot of time talking about boats. We're really pumped about that. Obviously. Let's talk about zombie islands. Do we have any thoughts about the second quest? Besides double-sided locations, hallelujah, double-sided locations are the best.
Yeah, I love it. I love it in terms of story. Like, the whole story of the downfall of Numenor is one of my favorite stories. And, like, if I could have that somehow translated into a cool movie or TV show form, I would love that, because it's such a compelling story how, Sauron basically just took down this whole civilization. So the idea of kind of setting foot there and seeing this, you know, these nods to all this old stuff is usually my favorite stuff, like nods to Morgoth and all kinds of stuff. It's amazing. And in terms of the actual mechanics, yeah, double side locations are the best. We've been crowing on this podcast about locations should be more exciting. And this is an example of doing that to me, that, like, this is the first time that it's actually like, yeah, we don't know what's at that location until we actually go there. That totally makes sense.
Yeah,
but we can scout ahead and see what's there. And yeah. Yeah.
And thematically as well, having the Lost Island card that's always out there, you know, invariably it made me think of a Forbidden Island, you know, or other games where you're discovering stuff. So there's always the presence of the island without you knowing necessarily what's going to come. So I hope they use that more in the future. I don't know, you know, we were saying that they want to reinvent the wheel every quest, which is okay, but I do hope they use something like that, because it made the locations feel a little more authentic. You know, it's not like, oh, I happen to know that the East Bight is exactly there on the horizon, you know, when the staging area is meant to represent threats that may come our way. I feel like it adds a little bit of mystery, which I hope that they come back to later on with the double-sided Lost Island cards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. And I think one of the specific frustrations I had with locations, you know, in the past was how anticlimactic they are.
Yes.
That once you've shuffled through the encounter deck once, you know what all the stats on all of them are. You know what all of the travel costs, all the negative passive effects of if it's in staging or if it's active or whatever trick it is you need to get around it. And then it really just becomes, you know, maybe there's one bad location that could wreck your day. Other than that, it's just kind of this, you know, you drop your northern trackers, you drop your Asphaloth, you plow through them. It is what it is. But in this one, the fact that there is, you know, it makes it dramatic, because when you choose to go to one, you don't know what it's going to flip to.
Yeah.
And I also really like the detail that you can actually put progress on them while they're in the staging, and all that lets you do is it lets you peek. That's a really great detail, because they could have run the risk of saying, okay, Asphaloth and Northern Tracker and all these cards are just about useless except for dealing with the active location. But I like that they're like, no, we'll make it so that they're still useful. And when you think about it, I mean, having rangers on a tropical, you know, island is a useful thing. They would be able to, you know, go scout out and figure things out for you. It's not as game-breakingly powerful to have Asphaloth in that quest, because you still have to, you know, you're not necessarily going to have time to be able to scout out all these locations in the staging, and then you still have to take the risk when you go somewhere of, you know, where is it I'm going, or am I able to find the shrine that I'm looking for fast enough?
Before we move on much further, I feel like I must comment on all the 2As in the Greyhaven's quest, the sailing's quest, how every stage 2A, the flavor text is like, Calphon just suddenly happens to remember something one day at breakfast. And by the third grade, you're like, I'm not listening to you anymore, Calphon. I don't care how many dreams seriously. You've had or how cool you are with Círdan. You sound like an idiot.
You're like searching through. Where's the quest stage that says dump Calphon overboard?
He's the new Nalir.
Where's that one at?
That's funny. I agree. Jeez. And the all the nods to Morgoth were so good that there's this brilliant article on the Master of Lore blog about it. I don't know who wrote it, but it was really good.
Yeah, you have a blog, huh?
Classic.
Classic. Oh, well played.
By the way, unfortunately, Matthew couldn't join us. He is...
He's going to sarcasm camp, right?
Yeah, Matthew's off at sarcasm camp getting therapy. No.
I think he would be one of the camp counselors. Teaching young impressionable souls how to get in touch with their inner curmudgeon.
That's right.
Curmudgeon camp.
Oh, curmudgeon camp. That's awesome.
That's fantastic.
So good.
We miss you. Have fun at curmudgeon camp, man.
Yeah, come back soon. We expect postcards. All right. The third quest is the raid on the Grey Havens. I don't know about you guys, but I immediately felt a little bit of PTSD with this because the burning buildings took me to the attack on Lake Town. And so I was a little bit threatened. This is the one I play with my buddy John up in Tennessee. And we were both kind of shaking in our boots a little bit because we have the immediate association of fire and attack on Lake Town. But it wasn't that bad. It wasn't that traumatic.
Hmm. Yeah, it's very much kind of... the oddball out, not in terms of like it doesn't fit with the rest of the box, but in terms of it might not fit with your deck. Like you can create a deck that will sail through the first two quests. But when you hit the third one, because it is much more combat focused, and the third one is kind of the one that says, yeah, good luck trying to avoid combat. That's the one you might have to make some tweaks to your deck, but I really enjoy that one as well. It's different than the first two, but each of the three quests is kind of has their own unique challenge.
Definitely. I don't know if we did it wrong, but we managed to beat it the first time, and really the key was I was running a mono spirit Noldor and he was running tactics lore, actually mono lore, lots of Ents, and we were able to keep our threat low enough to where we didn't have to engage a lot of the big guys, and so that allowed us to quest pretty hard. We were skin of our teeth. We almost lost all the locations to the Haven's Burn card, but we managed to pull it out.
You get punished heavily for leaving any enemies in play, though. So
for sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one. I've beaten the other two, but that one crushes me every time I've played it. I've only been playing it solo, to be fair, but yeah, it is. I need to make some kind of an uber combat deck, but I mean that's the challenge of solo is that I have some really heavy combat decks, but I don't know that they would quest well enough to not threat out.
Yeah, I was having a lot of trouble with it with my kind of traditional like Boromir, Glorfindel, Galadriel, which I throw against everything that's giving me trouble to see what happens. And actually, the saving grace was when I threw Beorn into my deck. You'll appreciate that, Dan.
Nice.
And then the main reason was that so I would meet the magic number of 8, which is what you need to kill the initial enemy, who I can't remember the name, and I was going to try to search it real quick. Oh, so here's Ravager. So you need 8 to kill that guy, and so I found the like you're saying, Dan, you really get punished for leaving enemies around. So I just built the deck around, you know, just kill them as quickly as possible. And still, basically, the deck is Círdan, Glorfindel, and Beorn. So it can do well in combat, but also quest well. So
that's a cool deck.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it puts a lot of pressure on solo players because you have to quest like crazy, but also, you know, do a lot of work in combat.
I will hang my fuzzy head in shame and bury it in my paws that I didn't think to include Beorn. That's a great idea.
Bjorn likes to feast on Corsairs. Yum, yum, yum.
Yeah, we may have missed a rule.
Salty.
There's, you know, I'm thinking about it now. There's a chance we maybe missed something. I don't know. Maybe we skipped. I don't know. We could have fudged the rules or just missed something, and that allowed us a victory, but...
I'm not here to crush your dreams, Derek. If you wanna think that you won, you should think that you won.
Well, if I say I win, I win. That's just kind of that's the house rule. Like if you're playing with a 2-year-old,
that is the best of all house rules.
Yeah. Anyways, I did enjoy that one. It was very eurytian. It was a departure from the other ones, and a little bit of a thematic departure too. I was not expecting to go back to the Grey Havens in the same box, but it's a good one.
And the when we had Matt Newman on to talk about the Angmar Awakened cycle, he was talking about how they really wanted to stress these kind of this antagonist character of Thardir. And in this quest, we get our new antagonist, two of them actually. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Sahir and the Asiyas. I'm guessing how that's pronounced.
Cool stuff. I'm sure they those guys are so thorough. I'm sure there's some kind of linguistic explanation. But yeah, the fact that they're double-sided is very interesting too. So it'll be nice to see that come back around as the cycle continues.
Yeah, I guess the first time we saw that like enemy objective ally was I want to say Gollum Smeagol, but it's something that I really like that we're seeing again.
Because it possibly means we're going to be teaming up with Corsairs in the future, perhaps. Well, we had a lively discussion on the social medias, and we got a lot of great questions from you guys, so we're going to skip to that now. And the first question is it suitable to play Grey Havens with a limited card pool for newish players with just a core set? I would not say you probably don't want to jump in with just a core set straight to Grey Havens. I think you could pull it off. If you started building some very particular decks, and it would be fun to play around with, but I don't think you would be as winning as you want it to be. Maybe it's just because I personally lean on a lot of newer cards, just because they're new and I enjoy them. But I don't know, what do you guys think? Could a new player make it through the Grey Havens and still enjoy themselves? Or win?
It's a tough one. It's always hard for me to answer this question, because the proof is in the pudding of kind of actually trying to build a deck that's that limited. They do always, both Caleb and Matt always make the point of saying that they try to playtest it each new expansion with just the core set. So it's probably possible. But then you also run into the thing of an experienced player who kind of has a lot of experience with the game might be able to pull it off. But a brand new player with just the core set, I don't know. I would probably say you'd probably want some other expansions in your belt first. You don't need to buy everything, but maybe.
I would add to that a strong recommendation for playing in an easy mode if you have a limited card pool.
That's a good point.
It's unfortunate that the metagame has this kind of stigma against it. But I really, and more, especially in multiplayer, where some of these quests can be just absolutely brutal in multiplayer, I really find myself just, even saying to the other guys in our group, like, hey, let's try this again at some point in easy mode if we keep getting crushed by it. Because it's hard, especially when, and one of the things that makes that challenging with our multiplayer group that I think is applicable to this question is that you have people that will show up with, like, maybe just a core set or just a core set and a couple of APs, and they say, oh, I want to make a deck and I want to play. And of course we want to be inclusive, but it's difficult if a quest is at a certain difficulty level and everyone else has got these kind of power decks, and then you have someone come in with a much more limited card pool, that either they might feel left out because everyone else has got so much stuff that they could do with the newer, more powerful cards, or it might just be that adding the extra player with a weaker deck is going to kind of cripple everyone else because you have, the game's gotten much better at scaling pretty smoothly for the number of players, which is kind of bad news for someone just bringing a core set deck if it's not very well tuned for the quest. It puts you at a serious disadvantage. So I guess that's my one thing to add to what Ian's saying is, don't be afraid to try easy mode. It's not it's not a bad thing.
And I'd say as well that if you're just a brand new player and you start playing Grey Havens, you're going to need to do some research. But you have a lot of great support cards in Grey Havens. So while the core set doesn't have a lot of great allies, you still are able to put a lot of punch together with, like Eowyn and Legolas and Gimli. So there's potential there with a card like Grappling Hook. I wouldn't use it that much, but if I was just using a core set, that could be really useful with, say, a Gimli, to be able to use his attack power to quest at some point if I needed to. Or even I'm looking at Narya. You got kind of some crappy allies, but you send them questing or use them to defend or whatever, and now Narya is available for you with an unexpected courage to use Círdan and then use Narya to ready those allies and get them ready for potential combat, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, which is just to say that there are some neat tricks you can pull off with the Grey Havens that might augment and offset some of the less useful cards that you end up stuck with just a core set. And just play easy mode. All right, this one's for you, Dan. How is it solo? Lost Realm and Angmar were tailored for multiplayer. Do you believe this to be the same thing?
I really enjoyed it solo. I mean, the last quest, I'm gonna actually steal Ian's idea on that one. I haven't been able to beat it because I don't have much time for deck building lately. So I have my pre-built decks that are pretty good at a lot of quests, and I'll just take one that I think is appropriate and play it. And none of my decks that I already had built were good for the third scenario. But I definitely feel like the first two are not only are they good for solo, I think they're just a ton of fun. And that's not to say that they wouldn't be multiplayer, but I feel like both of those, because you get two ships in the first quest if you're playing it solo, you still get a chance to kind of like play around with the different strategies that we were mentioning earlier about like, do I quest with it? Do I use, like, a lot of times early game, you're going to probably end up using Dream Chaser for sailing test because it's so good at it that even though you're losing out on those stats, you don't necessarily want to go way off course in the early game and get, you know, just punished by a bunch of bad treacheries. So it's cool that you get two ships in solo, for example, and it's cool that the change to the way locations work in the second quest, I feel like is a major improvement to the normal way that locations work, whether you're talking solo or multiplayer. So I definitely feel like, at least with the first two that I can speak to with some experience, that they're both really good solo quests.
That's cool.
Yeah, I've had the chance to play it, all the quests through solo and have gotten through the first two two-handed, so I can kind of compare the two experiences, and I think it's a really good solo expansion, like Dan is saying, because there's these kind of new mechanics in there. It gives you something new to play with and experience as a solo player that sometimes you may feel like just not enough cards are showing up for you to really get a taste of what's happening, but I think it's really something new for solo players, and it will bring the interest that way. As far as difficulty level, I think the Grey Havens in general is a good balanced difficulty, that it's not too easy that you feel like, oh, that was, you know, not a good use of my time. But it's also not as punishing hard as something like the Battle of Karn Doom or even some of the other Angmar Awakened stuff. The third quest is pretty difficult solo. I haven't played it with more than one player, so I'm not sure how it compares, but I think because of the boss enemies, there being two of them, that makes it more tough solo, but it's still beatable. So this was the question we got asked the most. I think there was three variations on how this is a solo box, and I'd say definitely one of the best solo expansions out there.
I absolutely agree with what you said about the third quest. Now that I think about it more, is the fact that there's two boss enemies and that it is very combat heavy. I can see multiplayer with ranged and sentinel giving you a huge advantage. So it's not to say that you couldn't do that one solo, it's just going to be a lot harder.
True. The only one I played solo was the second one, and the next question asked us to talk about the Lost Islands deck. And I already talked about it a little bit, but I think the fact that it keeps a single location in play pretty much all the time is worth taking into consideration when you play solo, but I don't know, I didn't feel overwhelmed at all with that one. There's some really, really nasty effects on the undead and some nasty shadows, but I think generally if you're playing solo, you're going to be running cancellation anyway, so make sure those are in your deck. And the next question, what do you guys think about the ship and the boarding mechanics? We kind of covered that pretty well at the first part of the show. We talked a lot about the ships and a little bit about boarding. Was there anything else you guys wanted to add?
I really like them. I mean, I think it's, to go back to something we said in general, is that the fact that your decisions, and this is in my mind, that this is the right kind of difficulty, is the first two in particular, I feel like can be difficult if you make the wrong decisions with who you choose to quest with, who you choose to, you know, use for various facets of the game. They're very important decisions. You know, they always are in this game, but in particular, I feel like in those quests. So, it's boarding and ship mechanics are great because you have to think about, like, if I'm going to optionally engage this ship, what's going to come out of the boarding deck?
Right.
You know how many enemies are coming out because of the boarding keyword, but you don't know what you're going to get, and they have different various effects of when they engage or what they do. And it makes it interesting. It makes that decision of optional engagement more than just, oh, I'm getting this enemy with these stats that I know. There's some drama there of the unknown of what the crew that's going to come along with that ship.
I think, yeah, just as we've talked about before, I do really enjoy the mechanics. The one thing I'll say, kind of touching on the solo issue, is there is some variance as far as what ships, like if you draw an early Corsair warship, which is the one with like 8 attack and boarding 3. And more than that, because
archery 4
The archery 4 is the hard part, because you can take the approach of just leave the thing in the staging area and just keep going. But that archery 4 in solo, where you have less bodies to soak it up, will hurt. So it's not an impossible situation, but yeah, your difficulty may vary depending on if you draw that thing early.
And at least one of them is removed in easy mode, so do that.
Yeah, one of the tricks that I didn't realize until yesterday when I was kind of reading over the rule book more carefully to figure out some rules questions I had is that the Dunedain Hunter actually is good in this quest. It may not seem like it, but because the boarding keyword only activates if it comes from the staging area. So if you draw out a ship with the Dunedain Hunter, then the boarding doesn't trigger. You just have to worry about the ship. So at first I was like,
I did not even think about that. That's very clever.
I had that Hunter in one of my decks and I was like, I'm going to take this out. You know, he sucks for this quest because I just took the, but then I looked that over and I was like, oh, he's actually good.
Yeah, Mike and I got into discussion about that, the risk reward of that, because on the one hand you get the obvious benefit of a free fighter, but then you're taking on a ready ship. But, as you said, Ian, you circumvent the boarding keyword, which is actually really good. So there's definitely a real benefit to that.
Yeah, not to mention which, presumably in a deck that runs that, you're getting some other advantages from having an engaged enemy during, you know,
exactly,
as of the planning phase. Right. Like, it's not just avoiding that. Yeah, that's a really good catch, though, Ian. Good.
Let's talk about our favorite Middle-earth ship scenes. There aren't too many, but I think one thing that this was on Facebook, and Mike, the Master of War, commented about the tale of Arrendis and Eldarion, which is from the Unfinished Tales, which is worth mentioning just because Arrendis, who was the wife, takes on the name of Lady of the Starbrow, which may be one of the best Tolkien names ever, Lady of the Starbrow. But for me, it's obvious. It's the best ever. It is, of course, Eärendil versus and Caligon the Black.
Yeah.
Is it's a flying ship. This doesn't really get
versus
much better
a
than
flying
that.
Dragon.
Yeah, it's a flying the elf with the Silmaril in his brow facing off against a giant ass dragon in the sky. It doesn't really get a whole lot better than that.
Yeah, so that's as epic of a scene as you're ever going to get in any kind of fantasy.
Yeah. So it gets a little, you know, that's kind of the trump card. I don't know, do you guys have a particular ship scene that you enjoy?
I have to follow in Caligon the Black.
I know. I played my trump card too early.
It's Frodo's parents drowning.
Too soon. Too soon.
That
Hobbit
was a
lives
boat.
Matter,
to be
Hobbit lives
to
matter.
Be literal, that was a boat scene, not a ship scene.
So yeah.
Technicalities.
The sacking of Pelargir's got to be pretty cool with the Army of the Dead.
For me, mine is not so much related to the actual boat scene, but just because what it kind of grows out of, which is, again, is kind of the downfall of Numenor, which is all the faithful kind of trying to escape this sinking disaster.
Riding a tsunami to the coast of Middle-earth.
Before the pain comes down. And it's just that whole story is really amazing. And just this idea of them kind of trying to get out before, the mess comes down on them. There's actually a person, I can't remember the link off the top of my head, maybe I'll try to find it and link it, who wrote this crazy long, like, kind of screenplay story version of the downfall of Numenor, like drawing on what Tolkien wrote, but injecting their own stuff. But it's really pretty amazing, and cool. I wish someone would actually turn that into a film one day.
I'd watch it.
Just as long as it's not Peter Jackson.
Hey, man, Peter Jackson got shot on a boat in the Return of the King, so that's my favorite ship scene. Peter Jackson and the other guys dressed as Corsairs.
Nice.
Sounds ripe for the Second Age expansion, Ian.
Yeah. I'm sure I'll get to that in 2040.
About the time the game ends. I'll just pick it up.
little Joaquin's going to be able to play and co-design with you.
Yeah, so you're still going to hand off the reins to him at that point.
The next question is goes back to ship combat, and this listener wrote, I feel very limited in my choices in ship combat, especially in solo, even with the extra ship. I don't know. I think... I guess my take would be that you have a lot of options as far as attacking, because you can just use your characters as you want.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't... And again, I haven't played solo, so maybe I should defer to you guys. But you don't... I feel like we weren't engaging that many ships. So I might have to take an undefended on my ship if I've got two. But it didn't seem like there were that many ships coming off the deck to where it just became overly difficult where I had no options. I don't know.
Yeah, there's a couple points I want to make about this. I get where they're coming from, but I think there's... So it goes back to the whole, you know, tension or drama, how that makes... It's really great as the bedrock of a replayable scenario. The difference between a scenario that, you know, a year from now you go back and say, oh yeah, I want to play that again, versus, no, I'm done with that one, is I feel like it needs to have some of that tension there. So you have these ships. If you lose the Dream Chaser... everyone loses. If you lose any of the other ships, that player that controls it loses. It's built some tension in, but they wanted to make it so that it wasn't easy necessarily to protect your ships, which again thematically makes sense because it's a giant ship. People are going to be trying to sink it. It's only fitting. So I definitely see where they're coming from of the limitation of, you know, you can only block their ship attacks with your ships. But I feel like one of the things that Matt and Caleb like to do is kind of make little tweaks to the metagame where if one thing starts getting really, really popular, they're going to kind of throw you a curveball to make you look somewhere else. And I definitely noticed that with ships where when I was looking at the first scenario and thinking about multiplayer and like, how can I build a deck that's going to help against this? I realized that with the Dunedain, there was a big push for traps, right? That's like kind of a sub theme that works really well with Dunedain is you can do like Damrod and you can have Forest Snare, which is amazing with the Dunedain, and you've got Ambush and all these other really cool things. But you notice right off the bat, and it makes sense, you cannot put a scouting ship in a Forest Snare. So again, thematic win. It is good that I cannot put traps on the enemy ship. So, but it begs the question of how do I prevent them from attacking and slaughtering off my precious, you know, Dream Chaser and, you know, and all these other ships that if I lose them, I'm out of the game. Well, Faint is a great card, which happens to, by the way, be in the core set. And this is kind of, I feel like this is kind of a metagame thing of like, well, let's move away from the traps for a while. You know, that was fun in Angmar Awakened, but, you know, the Dream Chaser cycle is gonna be about some different things. And, you know, as much as it might seem thematically weird to, you know, to faint out the enemy ship, you can retcon that to mean whatever you want. Maybe it's like your ship is fainting their ship or something, but the idea is you can make it so that their ships can't attack. You just have to get clever about how you do it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely limited in the choices just because of how the rules work, but yeah, I'd agree. You have some options in the player cards because they're not immune to player card effects, the enemy ships at least. So yeah, there's things you can do. This is a little bit of a tangent, but it brought into my mind because Dan mentioned how Matt and Caleb like to mess with kind of the meta and the way people are playing, and that reminds me of the second quest. Actually, something I wanted to mention that we didn't mention yet was how it has all these effects that punish you if you discard a card from the bottom of your deck that's two cost or less. And that mechanic actually really, really hurts because that's like most of my deck. Like, I build my decks with a cost curve that it's like right. mostly two cost stuff and less, so it just totally messes with that aspect of deck building. So that's cool.
True.
Yeah, it's in a roundabout way, it is kind of the return of secrecy, because people keep saying, oh, when are they going to support it? Well, this is actually a way to support it, is my secrecy decks aren't too scared of that effect, because if I have, you know, Resourceful or Timely Aid on the bottom of my deck, it's technically four costs. So
yeah,
it's one of the nice ways you can get around it, that and just play more expensive stuff.
This is next one is less a question, more of a statement. Narya. Okay. They want us to talk about Narya changing the meta, especially since Narya can be played on Gandalf or Kirdan. I haven't really considered that much. I haven't thought about Narya on on Gandalf, but that could be pretty insane, especially with readying from Shadowfax and all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, just because of how broad the effect is, ready any two allies, pretty much, the possibilities are huge, and I feel myself has only begun to scratch the surface, and the player base in general probably has. Is it going to totally change the meta? I don't think so, but it does open up a ton of possibilities for Kieran and Gandalf decks. Not so much the boosting stats part, but just being able to get extra actions out of any ally that needs to exhaust to get an action.
I do see a lot of potential there. We actually did have a question about the Strider card and the potential for the two hero deck. And I think that with Narya, I mean, and the, you know, insane nature of Gandalf, possibly covered with Círdan, could be really viable. I'd have to sit down and, you know, try to bang out a deck and test it out. But I think with the extra readying of Narya and the action advantage that's already inherent with Gandalf and Shadowfax and all the other goodies you can put on them, there's a potential for a lot of shenanigans there. It'll be interesting to see what the community comes up with.
Yeah, it's... Ian's absolutely right that the readying is really critical. I mean, obviously the boosting is good, and I've already seen it used to full effect with you know, Narya plus Ents equals insanity. Oh. Because their stats are already really, really good, but they when the one downside is they come in exhausted, and you say, oh well, I played two Ents this turn that came in playing exhausted. Let me have Gandalf get tired for a minute, and suddenly the Ents stand up and crush things because plus one to their stats is going to make it insane. So, I mean, that's one route you can go, but the more interesting thing to me is stuff like, you know, characters like, you know, Gildor or, you know, even like Warden of Healing, if you're getting, you know, pincushioned to death by archery, being able to have, you know, and if there's like an Elrond hero on the table, suddenly readying your wardens, you know, two of them, for example, at the cost of exhausting Gandalf seems pretty reasonable when you have 8 points of archery so yeah. in the staging area.
That's good.
Yeah, it gets, because, the way it has changed the meta, I guess, is just that traditionally reading ally effects have been rare compared to reading hero effects. We've had, like, Ever Vigilant and then, Leadership Faramir, the hero, came out recently, and the Narya, as long as ally reading continues to be a bit more rare, it's gonna have a big effect because it has, you know, bringing something that's a bit more rare and doing it in a big way because it's reading two at once, and giving that stat boost. I would like to experiment with, you know, a Narya deck and Leadership Faramir and just see how much you can just like ready allies like crazy and see what happens out of that, especially with an Ent deck of some kind.
And it presents the possibility of not necessarily a new type of deck, but one that hasn't been done a lot, doesn't it? Because we often focus on, at least I do, Voltron heroes, getting them all pumped up. And so there's a potential to do to get that same amount of work, not the same amount, but a comparable amount of work out of allies, right? Because if you're able to ready them multiple times and give them a stat boost and things like that, there's a potential to really play with that and make something new out of it. So I don't know. I'll have to go back to the forums. I haven't been on the forums in a while. See if people come up with some madness. Our last question is asking about strategies to beat the raid on the Greyhavens. We talked about that a little bit. But let's talk about that. Let's talk about Noldor build options as well, which was requested in the same question. One thing that works, I don't know, I feel like location control is key with the raid. You want to get those locations out of there as quickly as possible, and the obvious things that come to mind are Asphaloth and Northern Trackers and all that. You just have to make sure you get ahead of the Aflame keyword. And you have to get ahead of those nasty treacheries, so cancellation is a plus. But I will defer to you two, since you guys have blogs.
Well, Ian's the one that's actually beat it. It's still crushing me. But it's interesting with the location control, I would say, though, is that you kind of, there's kind of a balance you want to strike where it's not bad to let some damage go on an Aflame location as long as you can ultimately clear it out before it completely is nuked. So there's kind of this balancing act of like, yeah, I want to let a little bit, because the way it works, at least in the first stage, where you're automatically putting some on the lowest, it's like the lowest quest point or lowest keyword value or whatever, that if the only Aflame one you have is,
Dream Chaser.
Dream Chaser, you're punished for that. So, like, I guess I agree with the location control approach, but don't be too efficient at it, because if you make it so the Dream Chaser is the only thing out, a lot of the stuff's going to especially punish you for that, for, you know, being too efficient with your location control.
Yeah, I can't give the definitive word, because I've only beat it with that one particular deck in solo mode, so that's kind of a limited experience. But what I did learn from that is, yeah, 8 is the magic number that mm-hmm. kills the I forgot the name of the enemy.
Sahir's Ravager?
Yeah, Sahir's Ravager. And that's just part of the general strategy of just killing off enemies as soon as they appear or as quickly as you can. So prioritizing that attack power. And to speak to Dan's point, what I found success with is the early rounds are really about questing and managing things enough that you don't lose, obviously, and that your threat doesn't rise too much. But the early rounds are not where I'm really trying to press forward. It's more where I'm just trying to get control of the situation as far as the enemies. And then once I can get on top of the enemy situation so that, you know, they're just getting killed as they come out, then I'm going to push ahead to try to really get through these locations and move to the next quest stage. And then once the two bosses come out, when you're in solo mode, really the victory just the condition is about beating the captain and not the first mate. So you're really going to have a hard time trying to kill both. So just kill the one that needs to be killed.
Yeah, we force snared Sahir, and that took a lot of the pressure off, just not having to deal with that. Mm-hmm. Even though they, when you're playing two player, they bounce around. But that helped a lot. But I'm interested. I need to think more about what you said, Ian, about prioritizing the enemies, because you really, I don't know. I just feel like with that first quest phase, there's a lot of potential to start burning for locations to start burning down. But what is the condition on that Haven's Burn? The number of players times 3 or plus 3? Yeah, 3 more than the number of players in the game.
I believe it's plus 3, yeah.
So that's 4 locations. Yeah,
it's plus 3.
I guess it depends on the deck you're playing, doesn't it? Because if you're playing your Boromir, your Beorn, then you could pretty quickly get combat under control, and then you'd want to focus on location. So that makes sense.
Yeah, it's pretty much, and I guess it places a focus on that particular deck of getting combat. I mean, that's pretty much the reason why you always pick Beorn, is you want attack power quickly without setup, right? You don't want to have to play any more cards. You can't play any more cards. You just want a big angry bear to kill stuff. So, I guess it's a matter of getting attack power quickly without much setup so you can worry about the other stuff.
And just to add to what Ian's saying, and it was my experience, is that I did exactly what you described, Ian, in the first stage, where I was really just kind of managed and trying to set up, and I thought that I was okay. And it's one of those beautiful things where I didn't actually read 2B because I wanted to be surprised, and boy was I, because the boss enemies, I thought, okay, yeah, I can handle 2 boss enemies because the first mate is not nearly as bad as Sahir, but the one little line on 2B that is pretty important if you have other enemies out and you aren't doing what Ian recommended of, you know, keeping the enemies under control, is each raider enemy revealed by the encounter deck enters play with 1 resource. And there's something, actually it might be on 2A where each, yeah, it's 2A, add 1 resource to each other raider enemy in play. So basically I didn't do a good enough job in the first stage, like I thought I did, of keeping the enemies under control. So when it got to 2, they all got extra resources, and I got overrun by enemies. Well, is essentially what happened before I could even try and counterattack and kill Sahir.
Yeah, that's the little wrinkle, that if you spend too much time on stage 1, then, you know, and the both the boss enemies get resources on them equal to the amount of damage on the Dream Chaser, which I think in the case of the first time I beat it was like 7. So they were both pretty beefy. But, you know, I essentially just rolled out some chumps in front of them, which gave me enough breathing room to take care of it.
What do we think about Noldor builds? I mean, I've just done Círdan, Arwen, and Galadriel, and that works pretty nicely. I didn't get to do as many shenanigans as I wanted just because deck efficiency, so I didn't get to play around with,
Fair and Perilous.
Yeah, Fair and Perilous. So I didn't get to play around with that and some of the other cards. I really didn't find To the Sea all that useful, but I don't know. I guess with some of the beefier Noldors.
Do you have high cost Noldors in your deck or not?
The I for the purposes of this, the quest that we were doing, I took most of them out. Like, I had Lindir in there. I took him out. I didn't have Gildor. So no. But I can imagine being able to make Gildor and some of the costlier guys cheaper. That'd be really beneficial as long as you planned your discards accordingly.
Yeah, so there's that. The other thing I've found is it's a great combo with Lindir because you dump your hand to play him and then you redraw the stuff you just dumped. It's a nice little, I mean, it's not, that's not a huge win when you think about it, but except for the fact that if you're doing it right, what you're dumping is stuff that you all wanted in the discard anyway. Right. So it's really just a win-win-win at that point.
That's been the hard part for me with Noldor, is getting my head around the fact that I want to dump stuff. So, so, you know, the combo that we figured out pretty early was Elven Light and being able to utilize that with,
it's an amazing card, yeah.
It's a great card, but then being able to use it with Sailor of Loon so you automatically get the bonus is really good. And now, but for me, it's Elwing's Flight and Anchor, you know, those cards that are supposed to go in the discard pile. It's me shifting my mental meta to build proper decks around that.
Yeah,
Elwing's Flight is so much fun to play with.
I've tried a few different Noldor builds, trying to figure out what I like best. I was doing Arwen, Círdan, and Glorfindel, I think I've had some success with. And then, you know, Aristor build. I think I still like the Aristor ones so far, just because I'm able to generate enough cards to dump them. The problem with some of the other Noldor builds I've had is when you kind of go all out with a lot of these effects that rely on card discard, you just end up running out of cards to fund them.
So you have nothing in play.
Yeah, it's kind of like with other traits where you get excited and you just throw in everything that works with that core mechanic at first, and then you kind of have to pull back and realize, okay, it's more about like, let me include those core cards that just do stuff without having me to fund them, and then just be more picky about which discard effects I'm going to make use of. I tried experimenting with Galdor. I do like that hero, but I almost feel like he's better outside of Noldor decks, or at least outside of Círdan decks, because that initial setup effect where you're discarding cards from hand to ideally set up those effects that rely on cards being in your discard pile, they immediately kind of get upset by Círdan and him forcing you to discard right away. But Galdor's definitely has a place, but I still haven't found a good Noldor home for him. But Círdan is a beast. He's a great hero. Yeah.
Yeah, you definitely have to strike a balance. Because like I said, for me, I've got to shift my thinking. And so I'm assuming a lot of other players are going to have to do that as well, especially with Círdan. Because you're thinking, I got to discard? I don't want to discard one of these cards, even though it's just the same as King Under the Mountain. So as long as you have a decent number of cards that you want to discard, you're going to be okay. Maybe throw in Will of the West to, you know, give yourself some, get your cards back if you want them. Or Dwarven Tomb.
Yeah. One of the keys to Noldor is you should never be afraid of having even a good card in your discard pile, because, I mean, either it's going to be good because it's in the discard, you know, as is the case for a lot of the strictly Noldor stuff, or, you know, if it is a good card, there, you know, there's Dwarven Tomb,
Harp,
there's Will of the West, there's the
Harp.
The Harp, yeah, and there's also the Weaver, like, top card of your discard gets shuffled back into your deck. So there's numerous ways at this point to get it back, so it's not like it's gone for good, and you just kind of have to embrace the fact that it's a different a different flow to it. I agree with what you said, Ian, about Galdor. I like him, but the best way I've seen him used so far was someone made a secrecy deck where they were only in secrecy the first turn. Like, it starts at 20, and it includes him, and they basically just say, well, what are the things you really want turn one in a secrecy deck? You want resourceful. So you use Galdor to be like, I am going to, you know, between Daeron's runes and, you know, whatever other card draw you're going to have in the deck, and you know, you're going to have your three of resourceful, you just make sure that you have that resourceful in the opening hand, and then from there, it doesn't really matter what the deck gets, what else it gets in the hand, you're going to be able to draw into your other stuff. But the key is getting that, you know, because lore, especially heavy lore, doesn't really have resource acceleration, so if you get that opening resourceful, the deck kind of runs. But to Ian's point, that's not really Noldor, that's really just kind of, he's good for, like, combo decks or decks that really want a certain card in the early game.
Right.
He's a fantastic hero for that. But, yeah, I'm having a lot of fun with it. One of the things I like about Noldor is that whereas before key uniques, I would really always go three of, You know, something like Light of Valinor was just is a 3 of card. Even though I don't like drawing the extra duplicates later, it's such a powerful card. It's so cheap, and it gives you that immediate action advantage on some really powerful heroes. In the case of Noldor decks, so you would just go with 3 copies of it. Now I like that I'm building a lot more decks where I have, you know, in a lot of cases, just 1 copy of a unique, because I'm not really worried. And even if I get unlucky and draw 2 uniques with Kierdan's ability and have to discard one, I know that I'm going to, you know, have a Weaver or something else ready to get it back some other way. Right. But, and then I was just going to say, it just frees up deck building, because then when you notice you don't have 3 of on a bunch of cards, you suddenly have so much more room in the deck for interesting tricks.
Yeah, definitely. If the Noldor have a weakness, at least that I've experienced from the decks I've made, it's just quests that throw combat at you right away. Mm-hmm. That's where I've had the least success, because they just don't have as much of that kind of immediate combat power as some other deck types. there are ways around it, but like say, for example, I was running Noldor decks through the first 2 quests, and then when I got to the raid on the Havens where you just get hit with this combat, then I'm like, okay, you know, get out of here, Noldor. Let's bring in Bjorn, right? Let's bring in the bear. Enough with this elf crap. I think as we get more Noldor cards that can kind of be rectified a bit, like, there are combat options like Fair and Perilous and the Elven Spear, but with the Elven Spear, you have the problem again of adding another discard mechanic that you have to feed.
Yeah.
So there's just some little things that need
to
be
ironed out.
Why don't
you make like a 60 card deck? Seriously, what's the?
I've totally done that with Aristor for sure.
We're gonna do that.
No. If you're running Aristor and Kierdan, 60 card deck is not an absurd thing. All
right, there
at
it is.
All.
We're just gonna pump up the Elven Spear.
Yeah, the good thing I like about Aristor decks is I'll totally can throw songs in there to bring in Tactics Sphere, and that helps solve some of the problems.
True that.
You're right, though, Ian, because even with, like, I was going to say, you either need the Tactics Sphere or you need songs. Either way, though, you're not necessarily getting that set up turn 1.
Yeah.
And you still also need a Defender, because if you're using Arwen Hero, you've lost out on one of the best spirit-based defense boosts in the game. So, you know, somebody's got to block these giant enemies that are coming right at you, and then someone's got to counterattack and kill them. And unless you're going to enlist your friendly neighborhood angry bear, then you could be hard pressed in the early game with a Noldor deck.
True. Just throw an elven jeweler out in front of them, like, oh, go make your jewels out there.
one of the interesting things I've seen in multiplayer, and I don't know if this is intentional or it's just serendipitous, but Sylvan actually pairs really well with Noldor in multiplayer, because you can have like a deck that's running Haldir and like Legolas and, you know, Celeborn or whatever, and then it's doing all its bouncy fun on its side of the board, but it's going to have the range and it's going to have some pretty good attack right off the bat. And then the Noldor can focus more on questing and shenanigans and readying and cancellation and all that stuff, and healing maybe. And then you kind of have a nice balance there where the Sylvans could be much more combat-oriented, and the Noldor can be off reading books and, you know, contemplating the nature of the universe or whatever it is that they
play
do.
Playing Scrabble. Well, before we wrap this one up, we're going to take a minute to nitpick the Grey Havens and talk about the things we dislike, because we've already given it a pretty sterling review, but there are always downsides to even the best boxes. So what do you guys think? What were some things that you did not care for in this particular box? I'll start off by saying that this is more of a general gripe than it is about the Grey Havens specifically, but I feel like with the last cycle, especially the Ringmaker cycle, but with Angmar Awakened as well, and even with some of the quests in this box, especially the raid on the Grey Havens, your decks really have to do everything well. So I find that, because as we say repeatedly, I don't have that much time to commit to deck building. I find I just default, especially if I'm playing two-player, that I'll have the Kill Them All Tactics deck and I'll have the Questing and Cancellation Spirit deck, because that pretty much covers my bases. And it allows me to get done the things that I need to do relatively efficiently. And if I'm playing solo, I might do like a Spirit and Tactics deck. So I feel like that's the cheap default way to deal with those problems when all these quests demand everything from you almost immediately. And I understand that there are ways to prioritize and there are more subtle ways to deal with the quests. But I'm not taking the time or making the time to discover those. So I find that I default to the very specific, you know, quest, defend, kill, cancel mode,
rather than digging into newer, better strategies or more interesting strategies. And usually that's because the quest demands that I am able to do it all relatively quickly. Because that's exactly what I thought of when we were discussing the question, asking for suggestions about the raid quest. My thought was like, well, you kind of have to do it all right away. That's not a very good suggestion. but so just do it.
It's true. It happens to be accurate, yeah. Though. How about you, Ian?
Well, it's hard for me to find a nitpick because, as I said, this is like my favorite expansion ever. I'm sticking to it.
You just love Numenor.
What
about?
It's such like I'm gonna totally dodge the question for a second and and pine on more for how great it is, but just three quests that are very different from each other, like completely different as far as like setting and mechanics, but it just all works together, and that's what I enjoy. So I guess moving away from the quest, if I had to pick a nit, it would be something in the player cards related to what we just talked about with the combat. Like, this is a very small nit, but we only have one Tactics Noldor hero, and I wish we had another so that I could experiment more with kind of throwing in a Noldor kind of combat badass into my deck for that last quest without having to summon a bear to handle that.
All right, here's your nit. This is your nit.
Yeah.
What about, did you guys not feel that stage two of the first quest had the potential to drag if you got stuck in bad weather? As I know it's only got four quest points, but I just feel like it I don't know. I don't know if I didn't, if I'd read ahead, I might have been more prepared, but it just really felt like it dragged.
I mean, I'd say both Quest 1 and Quest 2 could potentially be on the longer side. I've had that experience with Quest 2 as well, that, you kind of have to be prepared for a little bit of a longer session, potentially, for both those quests. Yeah.
We just could not get back on course.
Yeah. This is, actually hearing you guys talk about it made me think of my nit, because I'm with you, Ian. I'm overwhelmingly positive about this box. It is one of my favorites. I really like the quests, and I'm sure that with bringing a giant bear along, I'm even going to like the third quest. If I have a deck that's better prepared, it's going to be a lot more fun, which I think is a truism for the game in general. But my nit is actually going to relate to one of our earlier listener questions. And it's when I look at the player cards in this box, I realize that they're fun and there's some like really toolboxy stuff. I really like, Mariner's Compass. I like, all the events that trigger multiple times based on the discard, I think are all good. I even think To the Sea is really cool in the right Noldor build with some, good beefy allies to play with it. And that build also includes Narya. Segue. So there's some cool synergies in it. But that said, I really feel like this is the kind of player card set that works particularly well when you have a large existing card pool, if not the entirety of the player card pool. And in terms of like out of the box experience, it kind of reminds me of Heirs of Numenor again, where if a new player were to come and be like, oh, like we have people that are showing up at our, Thursday group in Austin again and being like, oh, all I really have is core set decks. What should I get? And it makes me not want to actually recommend this, right? Even though I like it and I think it's a great set, I wouldn't necessarily recommend it to a new player because you end up with a bunch of toolboxy player cards. And when you combine those with the core set, you wouldn't really be able to make a viable deck necessarily. Mm. Whereas I feel like there are other, and again, I'm saying strictly player cards. I love the scenarios, but the mix of the player cards to the scenario is kind of weird where like, yeah, Lindon Navigator is amazing, but what in this box are you going to use to kill anything in the third quest, right?
Yeah, that's actually, that's a great point.
You're not going to use Grappling Hook. You're not going to use Skyward Volley. I mean, I guess maybe if you keep allies in the discard, your Mythlon Sea Watcher is going to help you, but it just, it's kind of dicey, for new players.
Yeah, the player card set is kind of like, I think as experienced players, we immediately look at those and go like, oh, location lock solutions and like, cool, like stacking effects. Like that's all stuff that's very cool for us. But yeah, that's a great point that it's maybe not as friendly as the player card sets for some of the other expansions. And like, I know all of the deluxe expansions focus in on a trait. That's just how they work. So this is the Noldor stuff. But, like, if you look at Heirs of Numenor, which is terrible for new players in terms of the quests, the upside is they do get a player card like Baragond and Defender of Ramos.
That's amazing. Yeah,
like, those two are, like, immediate defensive solutions, which is a huge area of the game for new players to figure out how they're going to defend stuff. Aaron Rider to manage resources, Ranger Spikes, like, those are, like, key cards that have really had life since then. Even Voice of Isengard, Deep Knowledge, one of the best card draw effects in the game. Like, it'll take some time. Maybe months from now, we'll look back at this player card set and maybe something like Narya will be in that role. But, looking at it now, they are a bit more specialized to Noldor, which isn't going to be as immediately useful for newer players.
Good point.
And that said, that nitpicking was me with my new player hat on as someone with the full card pool that likes toolboxy cards and likes playing around with different effects. I really like the player cards too, but it does make it challenging when you have new players integrating them with a group of players that have the full card pool. It's kind of like a juggling act sometimes.
Well, anything else before we sail away here?
Nope.
I'm excited to see what the upcoming cycle brings us. That's all that I have to add.
I'm getting too old for this ship.
glorious. So many nautical puns you could throw out there.
I'm trying to, if you're an Arrested Development fan, the whole fourth season gets into this thing with maritime law and this recurring joke, so I'm gonna hit that pretty hard as soon as I can figure out how to integrate it into our episode. So look forward to that. That's not a reason to stay tuned.
By all means. By all means. There's always money in the Dream Chaser.
Yes. So good. Well, this has been episode 37 of the Great Company Podcast, brought to you by our patrons. If you like what we do on the show and you want to support our contests, hosting fees, and so on, and Gen Con trips, I don't mind telling you, please head to patreon.com/Greyco to sign up. Extra super special thanks to Max, Thomas N., and Mike K., our latest to join the Hobbitry in Arms. As always, you can find us on the socials, all of which are linked on our website at greycompanypodcast.com. From there, you can connect with us on Twitter, Facebook, whatever your platform of choice may be. Please send all of your comments and emails to thegreycompanypodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to read your questions and comments, especially on the air. Thanks to everyone who participated on Twitter and Facebook and gave us some wonderful questions to discuss on this episode. We will see you next time, hopefully as the full 4-man Grey Company on the next episode, when we will probably be returning to book club. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Happy sailing.
Happy sailing. Shout
out. Oh, shit. Get your towels ready. It's about to go down. Everybody in the place, hit the open deck. But stay on your mother toes. We running this. Let's go.
I'm on a boat. I'm on a boat. Everybody look at me, because I'm sailing on a boat. I'm on a boat. Take a look at me, straight floating on a boat on the deep blue sea. Bustin' by night, wind whipping out my coat. You can't stop me, cause I'm on a boat.
Picture drink, I'm on a boat. We drinking Santana champ, cause it's so crisp. I got my swim trunks and my flippin' floppies. I'm flippin' burgers, you at Kinko, straight flippin' cabbage.
I'm riding on a dolphin, doing flips and the dolphin splashing, getting everybody all wet. But this ain't SeaWorld, this is real as it gets. I'm on a boat, motherfucker, don't you ever forget.
I'm on a boat and it's going fast, and I got a nautical theme, patch me to Afghan. I'm the king of the world on a boat like Leo. If you own the show, then you show not me. Oh,